Hello, everyone.
I'm Kate Hennessy, and you're listening to Get Focused Radio. Stay with us for the next half hour, and let us inspire you and help you refocus when life gets in the way. Each week on Get Focused Radio, we'll bring you guests that have overcome challenges, guests who will inspire you, and guests who will share tools and techniques to help you create the life you desire. Connect with me after the show through Kate, ask Kate Hennessy at getfocusedradio.com. Folks, today we've got a really special show for you. It is Nellie Olson Day here on Get Focused Radio. And I'll tell you, I was a big fan of Little House on the Prairie, but not so much of Nellie Olson. That girl made me so upset the way she treated people. And I know I'm not alone in that. But I'm here to tell you that actress Alison Arngrim, who played Nellie Olson, is nothing like that character. She is a loving and very courageous girl who is really making a positive difference in our world. And I am very proud to share her with all the listeners today. Alison is best known to viewers worldwide for her portrayal of the incredibly nasty Nellie Olson on the much-loved, long-running hit television series Little House on the Prairie. And she continues to amuse audiences through her many film, television, and stage appearances. As a stand-up comedian, Alison has headlined at nightclubs such as The Laugh Factory, The Comedy Store, and The Improv in Los Angeles, as well as The Cutting Room in New York and assorted comedy venues all across the United States and Canada. In 1986, when her friend and Little House husband co-star Steve Tracy passed away due to complications of HIV, Alison immediately began volunteering at AIDS Project Los Angeles, and she continues to serve on that council today. She currently serves on the National Advisory Board of the National Association to Protect Children, and she's fighting to give children a legal and political voice in the war against child abuse. We are also going to talk about her new book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated. The book will touch your heart, and you'll want to give her a big hug, and you'll never think of her as mean Nellie Olson again, a guarantee. Before we get started, I want to share the call-in number with you. You can call in and ask Alison questions. The call-in is 1-888-435-1293 or 1-646-200-3268 and press 1. Without any further delay, Alison, welcome to Get Focused Radio.
Well, thank you.
I'm thrilled to have you on the show, and of course, as I told you before, our friend Sue London wanted to make sure to send out a big shout-out and to tell you that she says hello and knows that she's hoping to see you pretty soon. And we want to know when you're coming to Canada soon, too.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I have to get up there. It is, I am a Canado-American. My whole family are Canadian. I'm dual. I got the card.
You're dual. Well,
but,
and it's hot
so
for you.
At some point.
Yeah, it's hot for you in Los Angeles. It's boiling here.
What is with this heat? And I just left New York, and everyone said I got out of town just in time. It was almost 100 degrees there the other day. It's at the East Coast. We're almost mild by comparison, and then it's hot here.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. You know, I must say, I had a chance to, I just finished your book, and you've had quite a journey.
You were putting it mildly, right?
Wow.
I had to put it all in, you know?
I think you covered everything, and as we said before, some of the book is hard to read.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is a little squirmy, uncomfortable in my skin, and yet you just lay it all out there, and, you know, wow, that's amazing. I'm just so impressed that you were able to share everything, and I mean everything, folks. I encourage you to grab this book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated. It's just going to turn your head around. Can we talk a little bit, though, about life before Little House on the Prairie? Can you share a little bit? What were your early years like? You know, were you a child actress always?
Yes, actually. In fact, it's funny. You know, I just got my new SAG card because the unions merged, and my card is it says you know, member since 1967.
Wow.
And whenever there's like a meeting of SAG people and people should have to come in and show their cards, you know, meeting, you know, member since 1993, member since 1995, member since 1982, and they're like, wow. And once I was at a meeting where as people raised their hands, they had to identify themselves. They had to say, you know, John Smith, SAG member since 1988. And people got kind of show-offy. And if anybody was talking about a member since 1979, people, oh. And I raised my hand and said, Allison, I'm a member since 1967. And everybody went, gasp. And they said, good Lord, dear, were you playing a fetus? I mean, how old are, remember since 1960, how old are you? I mean, I look fairly young, and they're going, well, how old? And they're trying to calculate how old could she possibly have been and got in the car, and good Lord, how old is that woman now? And I was like, okay, yes, I was five, and yes, I am 50 years old now. But, yeah, I started doing commercials and working with a tiny, tiny little girl. And I thought everyone was on TV. I really did. My parents, my brother, my whole family. Everybody we knew was on television.
Well, you were a showbiz family.
Well, it was very strange. My mother, you know, all the cartoons. I would turn on the cartoons, and they were all my mother. My mother did voiceover work. And she was the voice of Casper the Friendly Ghost. She was Sweet Polly Purebred, Underdog's girlfriend. She was Gumby, and she was Davy of Davy and Goliath.
No.
Yeah.
I love Davy.
Exactly.
Davy.
And she thought that cartoon was really silly. She used to joke about it. Yeah, come on, Goliath, let's go outside and pray. And in Juno, Davy and Goliath was done by Art Clokey, the same man who did Gumby. Very interesting.
Right, right.
And no. So she was everything. So everybody was on TV. And,
yeah.
And actually, it's funny because when I got Little House, I was already 11. It was technically my comeback. I had worked a lot at 6 and 7 and 8, and then I hadn't worked very much. I'd done a movie at 10, and it kind of stopped. And my father actually told me I wasn't really breaking out and working very much, and it might be over. I might be washed up and not work until after I was 18.
Wow.
So I was really kind of done. So actually, people talk about, you know, getting my start in early age. I said, oh, no, I'm on, like, my fifth comeback. Little House on the Prairie was my second career.
So, and how old were you when you started Little House?
I was 11. I just turning 12 when we started filming.
Okay. Okay. And now, can you tell, now, in your own home, you didn't do, sit-down dinners didn't happen in your house. I mean, your own house is very different. Your real-life home was very different from Little House.
Yes. We would try. It was always very funny. We tried. At one point, every now and then, my mother and my father would say, we should all eat at the table. It's good for you. They said, yep, studies said we should all be eating dinner at the table at the same time. And then we'd go through the process of actually attempting to corral everyone to eat dinner at the same time at the table. And it sometimes worked. And we'd have flurries of this for several weeks. And then we'd go, oh, to hell with it. Because, I mean, everyone was so bonkers. It was the 1960s. Everything was completely insane. It was very chaotic and crazy.
Yeah.
And then people weren't home. People were always doing something.
Right.
So
and
I said,
yeah,
now and again, we try to sit at the table, but, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you came from a family where mom was working, dad was working, and then you put on the Nelly hat, and you went off to work there. And,
mm-hmm.
and our preconception of that was that this was the perfect family. I mean, mom, pa, everybody all sat down and ate dinner at the table, and little even Nelly, she was with the Olsons. I mean, they all sat down with her brother. You know, that's what you did. They were very family-oriented on the show.
Right, exactly. And that's why being on Little House was so, it was such a change for me to be in this very structured environment and to see all these stories where everyone's being such a perfect family and acting like, yeah, this is a fantasy. you know, I meet people all the time who tell me that the reason they watch Little House and why they loved it is they wish that their family had been like that, that
right.
they didn't have a life like that, and they wished they had. And, you know, really it was the same. I didn't have a family life like that, so, it was a complete departure for me.
Well, I don't think anyone did, even if you weren't in a showbiz family.
Right.
All the shows back then were, you know, the Brady Bunch and the Donny Osmond Marie show and the Waltons and all of that. Very, you know, most of us were sitting at the TV while our parents were doing their own thing, probably too much drinking and out and about and partying and all this, and we were sitting as little kids going, wow, look at that family.
Right,
that would
right.
be neat. Yeah.
And the fantasy is so seldom true. I mean, when you look at Little House, well, did not, you know, Michael Landon wound up getting divorced twice and married three times.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was no Little House in Caroline. It was, you know, nobody was having the perfect life. I mean, look at Marie Osmond. Marie Osmond has since come forward and talked about having depression and all sorts of terrible problems. So it's very often we watch TV and we think that people we see on TV have a perfect life. And it's extremely rare because, first of all, hardly anybody has a perfect life. And then secondly, really generally people who are drawn to being in entertainment have a screw loose.
Yes.
To put it simply, most people drawn to entertainment, there's something the matter with them they're trying to fix by being on stage or being on TV. So your odds that something terrible has happened to your person that you like on television are really high.
Well, I think the fact that each book, you know, you've written a book and other people have written books, and it's always a little bit of a almost a slap in the face for those of us who sat and watched those shows and fantasized about those that life, and then you read the book and go, oh, it wasn't like that at all. It was very much like my life.
Right? And, you know, I feel good in that I was able to at least tell people that as difficult things were for me, you know, with the physical and sexual abuse and everything I went through, that being on Little House was helpful, that Little House, this being on the set of Little House was wonderful, that the people on the show were really kind to me, and that the whole structured environment and the supportive attitude of everyone, that, you know, yes, you were right to watch Little House, and most of the people were very, well, Richard Bull was Mr. Olson, we voted him most like his character, that there was that kind of camaraderie and family atmosphere amongst the actors, and that it was a very healing place. And
right.
So I'm glad I was able to tell people that was true, because people go, you know, please don't tell us that being on the show sucked. It's like, no.
Well, they don't want to hear all that. No.
they,
I mean, some want to keep that illusion alive. And it was to a point, right? I mean, it wasn't all chaos and whatnot. You had, now mind you, some of the characters were a little bit different in real life, because I remember watching the perfect Melissa Sue Anderson.
Oh,
she was perfect.
And, you know,
Her hair was perfect.
I'm sympathetic to her, because if I had to be that character Mary, that perfect, that off just really sanctimonious in some episodes, that sickeningly perfect and nice all the time, I'd probably flip out. I don't think I could handle it. I'm so glad I was Nellie Olson. If I had to be one of the nice girls, it would have driven me nuts. And I think that having to be that perfect, and I think she also had a kind of a stage mother who wanted her to be very perfect, and I think that pressure really bothered her, because, man, did she let us have it. I mean, Melissa Gilbert and I, we became friends right away, which is really crazy, because here we were playing mortal enemies, Laura and Ellie, and we hit it off. Something to chemistry. We were hanging out at each other's houses. We just became like sisters. And then here's Melissa Sue, is her sister, and we're like, oh, hey, you want to hang out with? No. And she acted as if basically Melissa Gilbert and I were filthy juvenile delinquents and she didn't wish to be seen with us. And we're just going, is it something we said? And I mean, yeah, as an adult I look back and it's like, yeah, you always have the one teenage girl who's like the homecoming queen, who's the cheerleader, who's going to be like that. And then also as an adult I look back and I go, okay, if I had to play that character and I had to live her, man, I probably would have been in a bad mood.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, now, you did try, though. I know, according to the book, you tried later in life, and I think everybody has done this, where you've had almost a nemesis or someone that was horrible to you younger when you were younger, and you see them later on. You're grown up. You're mature.
Right.
You're going to try and see if maybe it was all just, you know, something that just didn't click back then, but now you're grown up. You can be buddies now.
Right.
But that didn't happen for you, Melissa.
I did. I tried to start a little conversation at like Landon's funeral, and it was absolutely no sale. Very polite, but very cool. I was like, oh, what a beautiful baby. How old is she? 6 months. And it just absolutely just got nowhere. And that's the thing is that, yeah, and she's got her book out and everything, and if you read it, there is this very sort of cool, this is how much I'm going to tell you, and that's it. See you later. Have a nice day, pal. And
oh, okay. I have to get that because she doesn't share.
That's the thing is, I tell everyone, get all three books. You know, don't take my word for it. Go get Melissa Sue's book. Go get Melissa Gilbert's book. And read all the stories from all the different perspectives. But indeed, she was not into the idea of being pals. And it's funny, because I've had luck with that. I have had people who, when I first met them, we didn't get along.
Mm-hmm. Was that in this show or other shows?
Oh, in other shows. And there were people who I just, you know, didn't get along with when I first met them. And then I later met up with them, and we wound up talking and wound up becoming best friends.
Yeah.
Oh, it's very funny. I have hilarious stories about people. My friends are like, oh, yeah, remember when we were driving in the car and you said, get out of my car now. And it's like, wait, what? I was like, oh, yeah, we didn't quite start out as friends. And so I've had people who were, like, mortal enemies who I'm friends with now. So I see nothing wrong with that. It can work out.
It can work. You should write. That's your next book. My mortal enemies are now my best friends.
Oh, yeah, there's all sorts of people. Oh, God, this guy Jim, a good Canadian guy. I remember we first met, and, a bunch of people I knew were in a theater group with him. And, oh, we did not get along. I don't know how we got off on the wrong foot. Couldn't stand one another. And then, like, 2 years later, we met. We wound up going out to the movies together and hanging out and meeting all of each other's friends. And it was like, wait, didn't you two hate each other? Oh, yeah.
Of course.
It was like we'd gotten some wrong impression of each other, and we worked it all out and thought it was hilarious. And I've had that happen lots of times. It can work out. The only problem is it doesn't always. We sometimes put enormous pressure on ourselves to be perfect, to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And we know that it can sometimes work. And we hear these stories that people who were just, they hated each other, they later became friends. And we go, that's great. And we want to be able to say we're that incredibly spiritual person who can do this. Well, yeah, sometimes the other person doesn't want to play.
That's right, of course.
And sometimes it isn't meant to be. So we sometimes put terrible pressure on ourselves that we're going to forgive everybody, we're going to make up with everybody. And, you know, hey, give it a shot. But sometimes it really doesn't work and it can't happen. So you have to go, well, I'll just say I gave everybody a shot.
Yeah.
And sometimes it'll work and sometimes it won't. But you can't just say, well, I'm being a bad person that I haven't gone back and created a loving relationship here. Nah, you probably tried. So, chill.
Yeah, exactly. And when you're a child actor, I mean, it's very difficult to make those bonds. You're having different actors in and out, and you come from different spaces. You have different backgrounds. It's just real life, but not.
And as a child actor, you're encouraged not to be their friend. Competition is the word of the day. Some of the stories you hear about, like Macaulay Culkin, he wasn't allowed to play with other kids on shoots. His father was sort of, you are the star, you can't talk to them. And many child actors are very separated from their friends and from other people. The parents get it into their head, they're a great star, and everybody's beneath them, and it's really unfortunate. I kept all my friends from school. I continued to go to school and hang out with those people and make friends. But there's terrible competition, and we were pitted against each other in Little House. I talk about that in the book, that some of the stage mothers were so competitive, they would start rumors about other. I mean, it's one thing to start a rumor about another actor on a show, but you never met children. These are grown women starting rumors about other people's children to try to get them fired.
Now, was your mom stage mom?
My mother barely set foot in the place. I think my mother visited the set like 3 times. And she was working, was like, that's nice, you got a chef. My father came to the set a few times, since he was indeed a manager, and so he's my manager, he came by. But even he was like, I'm not going out to Simi Valley, I'm not going out to that location. Ugh. My Auntie Marion was assigned to me. This wonderful, my Aunt Marion, my mom's sister, I talk about taking me to the set, and that thing, she was retired, so I said, well, you're taking the set. So I had a stage aunt, but she was the most unstage mothery person on earth. She was wonderful.
Right.
And my father really, I guess technically, was a stage parent, but the thing is, as a manager, he had tons of other clients. So he wasn't totally focused on me. I wasn't his sole source of income, and I wasn't his only client. He'd say, well, that's nice, you're having a bad day. I'm busy, I got a guy making a picture over here, I'm going to his set. So I wasn't the sole focus.
You didn't
and
have the same
pressure. I did see so many of these people where the mothers were there 24/7, and that kid was the sole source of income. And it was the sole focus of attention, and it was brutal.
Yeah. That's now. Who was your favorite actor to work with on that show?
Melissa Gilbert, and then I guess close second be Steve Tracy, who played my husband Percival. Yeah.
Now, did you stay friends when the show was over with Melissa?
Indeed, and it's funny actually say because if you watch the show, you remember there was Mrs. Foster, the postmistress.
Yes.
The little old lady in the post office. Well, Ruthie Foster, who was a dancer for years and an actress, she was on Bonanza, and then we wound up on Little House. She just died recently. She was in her 90s. And she actually kept dancing till quite late, was in a show for older dancers. Well, she just passed recently, and there's a big funeral this weekend. And you know everyone's going. Melissa Gilbert sent the email and said, okay, we're all meeting over here, and then we're all going for food after this restaurant. And, oh, Karen Grassley will play. She's flying in. Now, who's picking her up at the airport, and who's driving her back?
Oh,
and
that's wonderful.
Just as an extended family, you know, the great aunt has passed, and we're all going to her funeral. Everyone is calling each other and talking about who's giving who a ride to the funeral.
Oh, that's awesome. And when is that?
It's this weekend, and it's absolutely, it's like a family event. I mean, and I talk to Melissa all the time. We're on Facebook, so we're constantly commenting on each other's pages and saying rude things to each other. And we follow each other, and on Twitter, we've had fake Twitter wars every now and then. We say, well, wouldn't it be funny if we pretended to have a fight like Laura and Nelly on Twitter and see what everyone does? So we'll start insulting each other on Twitter, see what everyone, have everyone become hysterical.
Now,
we went to we're at the age where we're having all our medical exams and tests, and we talk about how you must get your mammogram and you must get your colonoscopy. Melissa went for a colonoscopy, and she was talking about on Twitter, I have to go for a colonoscopy. And I said, well, do you need a ride there and back? She can't really drive home, you know, with the drugs and everything. She said, oh, great. So I took her, and we took pictures of her, you know, going in and coming out and everything, and discussed the colonoscopy on Twitter. And when she was done, they gave her a wheelchair because, you know, they won't let you leave a hospital without a wheelchair, even if you're fine. And she said, oh, good, I don't need a wheelchair. And then they said, no, no, you have to sit in the chair. And as soon as she got in the chair, she goes, oh, no. And we realized it's like, well, the episode where she pushed me down the hill in the chair. So we took pictures of me pushing her in the wheelchair, and we put them up on Twitter and Facebook.
That's
hilarious. Yeah, you know, we're grown women. We're middle-aged women. We're still doing goofy stuff like this. It's yes.
Well, now here's something that really intrigued me. I didn't know this, and I have my dirty little secret is, even as a very young girl, I had a huge, huge crush on Michael Landon. Huge.
Okay, everyone.
When I read,
you and everyone, yes.
Oh, yeah. I read this, and if I had known this, I would have been looking at him a whole lot differently, a lot harder, actually.
You've been watching the scenes where Paul runs down a hill in slow
motion. Oh, you bet.
I'm
telling because you said that he didn't wear underwear and he wore tight pants.
Not a stitch. It was the 70s, and guys were wearing the tight jeans and no underwear and the open shirt and the gold chains. Look, this is very popular. And he saw no reason to alter this just because he was
Pa. I could never say, oh, Pa.
Underwear. What is going on this show?
Where are your pants, Pa?
Right? Pa, you left your door somewhere. And I was like, oh, my God. But that's the thing. Everybody had a crush on him. And he knew it. And he knew people were tuning in because he was gorgeous.
Oh, he was.
He was taking his shirt off, and he was wearing a tight pants. He didn't wear underwear.
He always had his shirt off, too.
He always had
that shirt off.
Every time he got hurt, it was always his ribs.
Yes, that's right.
Did he ever break an ankle? No.
No.
They
have the bandages around, and they slowly wrap those ribs.
And that shirt would just stay off for days. And he was always shirtless. He was always chopping with shirt. Didn't it ever get cold?
No, not
you know,
Pa,
I've
apparently.
Been to Minnesota. It's cold. Don't go. When people in Minnesota don't go running around with their shirts off all day.
Now, I want to make sure, just while we've got the listeners here, I want you to just tell us, where is the website that they can go to get your book? And tell me that now.
Well, indeed, I'm all over the place. Your first stop absolutely is Amazon. .com. You go to Amazon, and sure enough, you look up Alison Argermore, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated.
Perfect.
And it's for sale on Amazon. On my own website, which is now hgd.com/Alison, the fabulous Howie Green Design presents it. And he's actually got a thing of it. He said, order book now. You can order on Amazon. You can order it on Barnes & Noble. You can order it at Borders. You can order IndieBound. And if you want to get an autograph copy, the great thing is, first of all, I'm all over the country. I'm going to be everywhere. I'm going to be at Laura Palooza in Minnesota, in Mankato, in July, the second week of July.
Okay.
Yeah, July, from July 12th through 14th, I will be at Laura Palooza in Mankato, Minnesota. They have I love the name, Laura Palooza. It's all there, Laura Ingalls. It's a very literature-focused event. Then the next weekend, I'm in Walnut Grove up the street, doing Prairie Days, and I'm going to be signing books at all of those, and then I'm heading over to Wisconsin to Heritage Hills. I'll be there. And then I come back, and then I'm in Michigan, then I'm in Wisconsin again, then I'm in Chicago. And it's the schedule's up on my website.
That's all on the website, right? Your schedule
on the
for
website.
The next,
it's yeah, the hd.com. And I've got it up on Amazon and Facebook. I'm on Facebook. I'm on everything. And
okay,
under
perfect.
Events on Facebook. But the Lauren Ingalls Wilder Museum in Walnut Grove, they, of course, stock my book fully. They make sure they have lots of them. And they do a marvelous thing where if you order from their website at walnutgrove.org,
mm-hmm.
They have a whole shopping thing where you can order books and things online. And if you order my book, you can request that it be signed. And they'll ship it out to me wherever I am, and I'll sign it and ship it back to them.
Perfect.
So
Walnutgrove.org.
Yeah. Walnutgrove.org.
Okay.
If you're somewhere that I'm not coming to in the next couple of months, which is pretty difficult because I'm everywhere, but if you're somewhere I'm not, you can go to walnutgrove.org, and they'll get you a signed copy.
You'll get a signed copy. So that's fantastic. I want to talk a bit about, I know because it's very close to your heart and you work on the committees, the loss of your Little House husband and your best friend, Steve Tracy. Can you tell us about that? I know you were extremely supportive with him. In the book, it'll bring you to tears because you were with him through it all.
It's true. My friend Steve, you know, played Percival. The character, when your husband and wife on TV, and in a great setup they had with Nellie and Percival, it was like Taming of the Shrew and everything. When your husband and wife on TV, you either adore each other or you can't stand each other. A lot of people married on TV can't stand to be in the room with one another. But we hit it off, and we were the kind of married couple on TV who become best friends in real life. And he was just the nicest person, and such a wonderful actor.
He seemed so nice. His persona came across the screen.
It's so sweet. All of that warmth and sweetness, he's absolutely just the most wonderful person and so funny. So we became very good friends. And so when he got sick, you know, here he is, 1985, he went public with his AIDS diagnosis. In the 80s, nobody did that.
Yeah.
And here he was, this guy who had been a Little House in the Prairie telling people that AIDS. And it was awful for me because I was very young and there was nothing they could do. It's not like now where there's 87 different drugs and if one doesn't work, you can at least try another. And there's nothing. And he got so sick so fast. It was horrible. And he was so young. And he kept saying,
How old was he?
32.
32.
And he kept saying, I'm going to fight this, I'm going to fight this. And I was like, yeah, but no, because at that time, people with AIDS tended to die in about 9-10 months.
Mm-hmm.
If you lived a year, it was a big deal. And he lived like almost 2 years from diagnosis. And now that's terrible. Back then, that was pretty good if you lived that long. Now people are diagnosed with AIDS and they live, you know, 10 and 20 years if they get on the right drugs. But here he was, and he was, you know, 2 years, and he was so ill. I mean, and he was so proud. I mean, he'd fall down and you couldn't help him up. He was so weak and sick, but he's like, no, I got it. And very self-sufficient. So I did what I could to help him, but that's the thing, he was very self-sufficient. And then as I started volunteering, I saw most people weren't as well off as he was. They hadn't been on TV, so they didn't have any health insurance, and they didn't have any cash. And his mother and his sister stood by him and, like, flew out from Florida to help him. People's families were abandoning them right and left. So when I saw this was going on...
Don't forget, that was a stigma back then. That was, you know, if you went... I mean, it was an actual reality where people thought if you went too close to people who had AIDS, you might get it.
They thought people were going to get it off the doorknob.
Yeah,
it was
we were so misinformed.
Insane. And people were just frightened out of their wit. And so as I saw this, I began volunteering, trying to help all these people who didn't have these resources. And then also to educate people via the hotline, go, no, you're not going to get it off a doorknob. No, go visit your sick friend and take them something to eat, for God's sake. And trying to help people. And I was able to do that. And, yeah, when he died, I knew there was not much other possibility at that point, but... To see someone that young, someone who was that full of life, die, it was just awful. And it really affected me. And he was so brave. I mean, he was doing experimental treatments, and he said, they won't save me, but they might save someone else later. And
to see
someone with that kind of attitude, it was just
amazing. Well, Allison, I'm telling you, this is not enough time. Half hour has gone by like that.
Instantly.
You've got to come back on.
Okay.
I want to talk more about the book, more about the things in it. I want to talk about what you're still doing with the AIDS projects and whatnot. And you are inspiring.
And do tell them to go over to protect.org, too.
Protect.org, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? You are a gift. And I'm so absolutely honored to talk to you today, and I will talk to you again.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Allison. And I just want to tell everybody that, remind you that one organ donor can save up to 8 lives.
Yes.
And you need to go to www.beadonor.ca. And it's today can mean a new life to someone tomorrow.
I got
on behalf
sticker
of
on my
guest,
license.
Do you?
I got a sticker on my license. Totally.
You've got to register it. You've got to do that because then it's registered and you're an actual donor.
Cool.
On behalf of my guest, Allison Arngrim, and myself, Kate Hennessy, we wish you an amazing day. We'll see you all next week. Thanks so much, everyone.
Cool.
We focus when life gets in the way. It is Thursday, June 14th, and I'm your host, Kate Hennessy, coming to you live on what looks to be an absolutely beautiful sunny day. Our special guest today is Mary McDonough. Mary McDonough is best known for the 11 years she played Erin Walton on the hit series The Waltons. However, many recognize Mary as a respected voice with regards to women's health and especially body image issues. Among the many topics Mary discusses in her new book, Lessons from the Mountain, What I Learned from Erin Walton, is her own struggle with body image, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, and being diagnosed with lupus. As a result, she has become an expert on women's health issues, testifying before Congress on many occasions. Before we get started with my questions for Mary, I want to share with our listeners our call-in number so they can have the opportunity to call in with their questions. So that number is 1-646-200-3268 or toll-free 1-888-435-1293 and press 1. So without further delay, Mary, welcome to Get Focused Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to have you on the show. Little Erin is all grown up now.
Very, very much so.
Now, I know our listeners will want to talk. I want to talk about the book. I want to talk about the health issues. There's so much I want to talk about. I don't even know if I want to share you with listeners, but I might have to. But I do want you to tell us a little bit about being on The Waltons, one of the most successful TV shows. Tell us a little bit about what that was like.
Oh, it was amazing. Now, you know, all these years later, we're celebrating our 40th anniversary, and there's a big event. Yeah, 40th anniversary of the Waltons, and there's a big reunion event on September 29th in Los Angeles that's open to the public and stuff. It's on Facebook and online, and we are thrilled to, A, still be alive and be part of this, and the show is so amazing. It's such an honor, and it touches lives in a way that I am just constantly, you know, stunned by. People just share the most amazing stories of the show touching them. So it was a wild ride, and I was just lucky to be on it.
It really, you know what, it did. It touched so many people. I don't think there's anyone that you talk to or that I've spoken to that doesn't know or has a favorite. You know, oh, I loved, you know, Richard Thomas. I love John Boy. Everyone has a favorite on that show and someone that they really kind of felt similar, felt very warm to. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. If you're a tomboy, you were related to Mary Ellen and a writer with John Boy.
Yeah. You know, I was so touched too, Mary, by, your book. I loved your book. Amazing things in there that you shared. And the fact that you shared certainly makes us feel very close to you. You know, you're very you're someone that people feel that they know. And I was touched also by the similarities of our lives. Of course, we have the Irish background. You're a McDonough, I'm a Hennessy. You know, your lovely memories of your parents and your dad. Now, that's where ours are a little different. Your memories of your dad are very sweet, whereas mine, not so sweet, not a very nice man, very abusive. I thought all dads got up in the morning, poured vodka in their orange juice. So different start as a child. So he was certainly, because I think your father, that's the first man in your life. And if they tell you that you're useless, you're no good, you're stupid, that starts your self-image. Now, I know that self-doubt starts very early, as it did for you, not so much with your dad, but being a child actress, what was your emotional health like as a child?
It was tough for me as well. I mean, my dad was, as much as I, you know, tell lovely stories about him, there's some stories in the book, my dad was tough, and it was never enough. You know, I mentioned at one point I was a straight-A student. And I was doing a show and on the volleyball team and a cheerleader, and somehow it just wasn't enough for my dad. It was always more, more, more. So that did affect my emotional balance. And then my second grade teacher also was very much about how I never looked right for her. I had stringy hair, and so that was very damaging to me. So when I started the show, I was very much about getting approval because I wanted my dad's approval and the nuns' approval and teachers. And so going into a place where I was already kind of emotionally rocky and being in an industry where it's all about people liking you, it did wreak a little havoc here and there.
Yeah, and I remember you saying your mom was kind of she comes across a little bit aloof in the book, not an affectionate, as affectionate as perhaps your dad was.
Yeah, that's very true. My dad, yeah. I think, got his hugs from us. My mom was very, you know, she was the adult child of an alcoholic who beat her. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't very cuddly. And no. but she was lovely, and she found her way through all of that. But she sort of would rather, didn't like conflict, didn't really want to know what was going on, and never allowed anybody to raise their voices in our house because of what she had gone through as a child.
Yeah, well, her story alone, which you tell in the book, is sad.
Yeah.
Very sad. And you can understand why she was a little bit more cold, a little more reserved than your dad, although your dad was a tough cookie.
He was a tough cookie, but very gregarious and really who, I mean, my brothers and I talk about how he is the one who really molded us because he was so out there and so, you know, with people and very much about being philanthropic and always giving back and counting your blessings and then, you know, join 10 nonprofit organizations.
Well, you know, you talk about when you started, it was really luck that you went on, you immediately were taken on to the show. You know, your hair had a lot to do with it, that gorgeous red hair, right? They were looking for a specific look, and you had it.
Uh-huh.
And you were, you know, you were considered the pretty one on the show.
Uh-huh.
So where did the lack of being, feeling as we perceived you, you know, looking back and watching the show, I certainly thought that Erin Walton, because that's who you were, was beautiful, as did
Thank
most
you.
People, you know. We grew up watching you, and you were on Tiger Beat, right?
Yeah,
in there with Donnie and Marie.
Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah. Awesome. And so looking at you, one would think, well, she's got it. She's just got it going on. But you didn't.
No, because I think it's the illusion of, you know, we always, I do a workshop, and I do a lot of public speaking now called Body Branding, Getting Comfortable with the Skin You're In, and I'm a life coach, and I work with people on these issues every day, and I always caution people about, you know, don't judge a book. Yes, I was the pretty one, and, you know, the makeup and the hair and the this and the that, but in being that, people assume that everything was really wonderful when, in fact, it was really difficult because I always had people talking about my weight and was I thin enough and why was I eating that? And, there's a certain pressure. And when I got to be a regular teenager going through what a normal body would be, I, you know, had a wardrobe woman say, have you gained more weight or can you fit into the same clothes from last season? And you know, hair people and publicists and people, you know, always, Erin was always in these beauty contests, but she always lost. And they always, you know, grandma would say, see, that's what you get for being vain. So it was kind of a mixed message for me as Erin and Mary of, you know, you're the pretty one, but people would whisper it to me like it was something that was really bad and it was going to hurt Judy and Cammy.
Right. And, of course, you had to be that combination because, I mean, trying to manage the pressures as you try to be Mary, not Aaron. You know, that had to be a whole other continuous battle, right? Because when you left the set, now you're Mary, but you're still a teenager. You're still that same, you're still a girl, you're still a teenager, you still have the same self-doubts. I know that you certainly battled depression and insomnia around that time. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened during those later teenage years?
Yeah, I just withdrew into myself. I read a Harlequin romance novel almost every day. I never got asked out on dates, so I was always out reading and writing, you know, keeping my 4.0 average. And I didn't have a lot of friends. I withdrew into myself. I was very confused, and I was sad, and I knew that I couldn't cry all the time because I couldn't show up for work with really swollen eyes, but I would set a timer, and I would allow myself to cry for a certain amount of time every night, and then I would stop, and I would just be awake and sad, and eventually I started to journal, which I think saved my life, but my hair started to fall out. Of course, I mean, I started to get this rash on my head. And my parents took me to the doctor, and they said, "Is she stressed out about anything?" And my parents were, "No, she has a great life. She's on a TV show. It's great." But I had this rash, which was all in my hair, seborrheic dermatitis. And, of course, I wouldn't let it go on my face because then I would get in trouble for ruining the, you know, the set work.
Yeah, yeah. Now, did you – how long did the Waltons run? How old were you when you were finished?
I was 20.
You were 20. Okay.
Yeah.
So now you're no longer little Aaron Walton. Now you're 20-year-old Mary McDonough.
Yeah.
Now what does she do?
now she goes
now what do you do?
Well, now it's the era of Dallas with, you know, big hair and big boobs and
big shoulder pads, which are awful on everybody. That was not a good look.
And you know, I wanted to work as an actress. I wanted to continue, and I did not have big boobs. I did not really have big hair, but I could have. And I kept losing parts to, you know, we went blonde and booby for this. And I just wanted to work so bad, and the stigma of the show and being typecast as the, you know, all-American girl. And certainly the producers of the Waltons went on and did other shows, and nobody would, you know, Dallas being one of them, you know, and they would not, I could not get a reading or an audition. And I started to study acting really seriously and doing theater. And I couldn't break that mold of that girl next door. And in one horrible choice that I made was to think that if I got silicone gel breast implants and got big boobs, then I would work. And instead of working, I ended up getting very sick. And over the course of 10 years, just my health spiraled down, which didn't help my career at all either. I didn't look well, but I didn't know what was wrong with me. And eventually I was diagnosed with lupus.
Oh. Now, tell me, I just want you to go back a little bit. When you would go to an interview prior to the breast implants, did they specifically say to you, would they be that outright, or did you just not get the part and you didn't know why? Did you assume that that's why you didn't get the part?
Both. My agent would tell me, well, they went blonde and booby with that one. They wanted drop-dead sexy. They wanted really pretty for this part. They wanted sexy. They wanted, you know, I would get that specific feedback.
Yeah. When you went to get the implants, when you spoke with your doctor, did you ask the questions that you think that you should have asked, or did you just say, yeah, sure, throw them in and let's go?
And no, I asked a lot of questions because it felt so unnatural to me. It seemed kind of fun in some ways because I was young, but it seemed so unnatural, and I was very frightened of it. And I didn't ask the information that we have now was suppressed then, so I don't think anybody knew the exact right questions to ask. But I did ask, you know, he said, "Oh, you might not be able to breastfeed." And I thought, breastfeed? I don't even want children. Who cares?
Yeah.
But yeah, I was young. But no, I did. You know, they said, "Oh, they'll last a lifetime. There'll never be a problem."
That's a lie.
Total lie. We know that's not true now.
Yeah.
You know, he said, you will be buried in your coffin and you will still have these fabulous breasts that are, you know, perky and, you know, like 15-year-olds. So, you know, that wasn't true. And
no.
We know that now. But yeah. I did ask questions, and, you know, within 24 hours after having surgery, I broke out in this rash. And then over the course of 10 years, had all of these different health issues, which just nobody ever really connected to anything.
Right. And I think I want to make it really clear to our listeners that if a doctor ever does say to you that you will, you know, you're going to have that one set, and then you're going to be put in your coffin at the end of 40 years or whatever and still have them, it is a lie, because they don't last. It's, your body will sag, it does stuff, and you will have to go and have these surgeries over and over and over. And
yeah,
they're not fun. They're horrible. They're painful. It's a horrible thing. I do want to go on and talk to you a little bit about the lupus, but I want to read a part, because I know that you made a decision to have the implants removed, and you still, it wasn't a cure-all. So you had the implants, and you would think then that would be fantastic, and I'm going to read this so that people really get what you're saying to us.
Uh-huh.
This is what it says in the book, Lessons from the Mountain, What I Learned from Aaron Walton. Quote, "A dear friend of mine took a series of wet T-shirt photographs of me, not for a poster or publicity to boost my career, as a publicist suggested, just for me. I was really trying on my new silhouette, getting used to the attention. It was a try at sexy, a try at a new body, a new self-image. But trying is not being. Sexy is being connected to your inner beauty. Sexy isn't a costume you put on or a plastic device you put in your chest. Sexy is a feeling from within, a confidence and sense of oneself. I did not know that then. Unfortunately, with all the inner turmoil, I began to hide my new breasts. I was embarrassed that people would know what I did and judge me. I felt fake inside. The silicone didn't fill the hole in me." I just found that absolutely so poignant, and it says so much that it just didn't matter that the same as getting really skinny or, you know, changing your hair color, having implants. Uh-huh. If it's not going on the inside, you're still the same person. It's not working.
Yeah, because there was a hole inside of me, and I wasn't dealing with what was empty. I kept putting things into it, food, dating people that were not good for me, partying here and there, implants, and I kept just trying to address, you know, the hole and cover it up, but it just, until I really just had to go inside and realize that no matter what I do, you know, no matter what people do, whether they tattoo or change their nose or fill up their lips or whatever it is, you know, it's like, why?
Yeah.
Why was I doing this? And most of my revelation in that, and it's what I work with people on now all the time, is like why we make those choices. If we can make them and we're okay with it, you know, then that's one thing. But if we're doing it for somebody else or some reason outside of yourself and thinking, if I do this, then I will be loved. If I do this, then that means I'm sexy. If
right.
I do this, I will get a husband, or whatever it is we tell ourselves. It can be detrimental, and it doesn't
yeah.
address the real inner core issue.
Exactly. When you develop lupus, do you think that the lupus was hand in hand with the implants? Do you think that developing that had something to do with that? And what are the symptoms of lupus?
I actually do. I get a lot of flack about that when
yeah.
people, you know, write about me, or, you know, I get challenged about it a lot because, as they say, there's no evidence. You know, if you go onto a plastic surgeon's website, there's no evidence to link it. But for me, I was a very healthy girl. I got these implants. I got very sick. I had them taken out, and I started to get better. I did get diagnosed with lupus. And lupus, there is some, you know, some studies that are out there now that actually do link an autoimmune response. And the FDA's own scientists found a link between an autoimmune response and implants. But that none of that's being done now because the manufacturers don't have to follow through with the research they were supposed to do. But lupus can be triggered by chemicals.
Okay.
I do not have a family history of lupus, so it was interesting for me to get diagnosed with lupus.
Mm-hmm.
It's a snowflake disease. Everybody is different, but there's discoid lupus, which is the external form, and systemic, which is what I have, which is the internal form. And the organ, you can kidney failure, rheumatoid arthritis, Sjogren's syndrome, which is a collagen disorder, sun sensitivity, photosensitivity, rashes, swelling of your heart lining, chronic fatigue, your hair falling out, a rash across your face, the butterfly rash across your nose and cheeks. Those are all symptoms of lupus.
Oh. So now, have you overcome? What do you do to get through? How do you handle lupus?
Well, I'm actually in remission, and I have to tell you, since I had my implants removed, my health has gotten better and better and better the farther away I get from that. And I've done a lot of detox as well, because my implants completely ruptured in my system. There was nothing left of the outer shell. There was just this gelatinous mass being held by scar tissue in my chest. So my body had access to all of these chemicals, and I have had, you know, things pulled out of my body, hard little nodules and it travels into your lymph systems. People have had silicone removed from their lymph glands and stuff. So I deal with it by now detoxing, being careful about what I eat. I don't go into the triggers. I don't go in the sun. I wear big hats, get bigger every year. I wear sunscreen clothes. I rest. You know, you try and stay away from stress and knowing, you know, what can trigger a flare-up.
Yeah.
But I deal with pain every day. You know, it's never, for me, it's never like, will I be in pain today? It's how much pain will I be in? Because I have fibromyalgia is a symptom of lupus as well.
Horrible, yeah. Now, I know that you you have a gorgeous 20-year-old daughter, Sydney.
She's beautiful.
She is beautiful. I saw pictures of her. She's gorgeous. I like her mom. Tell me, though, I know that Sydney had some health challenges. Was this part and parcel of what you were going through?
Well, hers were different. And, you know, I'm not sure because I never took her into any kind of extreme testing because it was so invasive. But there are a lot of children who have, you know, they don't have an implant to remove. But we know from Dow's earlier studies that certain silicones cross the placental barrier.
Right.
So it doesn't matter. And then the National Milk Banking Association will not take breast milk from women who have breast implants. So I guess they must have known something we didn't. And I did try and breastfeed, and then I also, you know, just being, you know, pregnant. And so I don't know if her health issues were directly related to them, but a lot of the children had very similar issues.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And there's
that.
No research being done on the children, and there's no research being done for implants themselves, really. So the children have been kind of lost in the mix. So I don't really know, but I do suspect because other women's children had the same issues with this.
And yet with all of the, you know, especially with the new knowledge going on, you still see the implants being done on the younger celebrities, the younger girls, and even the girls that aren't in the limelight. This is what they want because they are still seeing it. We're still being inundated by the TV shows that the big boobies are still, that's what you need.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's the general population now. You know, everybody wants that look and to be a star. And with all the reality programming, and there's so much support for it. Yeah, I mean, you figure how long implants have been around, and most men don't even know what a real breast looks like. I mean, even young boys, they're used to looking at Victoria's Secret, and you've got all these hardened ledges, you know, in these women's breasts. They've cut like a ledge that will fall off around the implant, and that's what we all is.
Maybe
their
hope
point of reference.
It would be like it's their beer holder. I don't know. Maybe that's what their hope is. The perfect woman, hold my beer for me. That's great. So tell us, what is life like for you now? What positive has come out of all of these health struggles for you?
I believe everything happens for a reason. And while I never wanted to be a poster girl for a boob job, it has brought most incredible people into my life, the amazing, powerful women that I have lobbied Congress with. And I have become a citizen activist for women's health issues, and I've been able to help people learn about lupus. So, you know, that's the silver lining. And I wrote the book, and in sharing my story and having people, wonderful people, write me letters every day about how it has touched them. It has brought meaning to my life. That is aside, you know, from the Waltons. And when I lead workshops and when I coach with people on the phone every day and help people rebalance their lives, it has been incredibly rewarding. My life is great. I'm very, very blessed. I'm a really lucky girl. And yeah, yes, some dreams were lost, but other dreams have come true. I have a great husband. I have a wonderful dog. And I have three great daughters. I have wonderful daughters who have a really great sense of themselves. And they don't want
breast implants. Do any of them want? They don't. No.
No.
Have they ever thought about it? Because they're how old are the girls? One is 20. Sydney's 20.
Yeah, and my stepdaughters are 20 and 18.
Okay.
And Kylie and Robin, and they, you know, they're very, you know, they've all gone through their issues, you know, and continue to do about being female and about what they look like and about, you know, their own, creating their own image, you know, what they are, the way they dress. They're very different in their styles. And when I see my own daughter go through it, sometimes I'm heartbroken. I think, wait a minute, didn't I tell you? I'm the living example of what you shouldn't be. But, you know, but everybody has their own stuff to go through. But they certainly are very aware. They really don't like that whole anything that's fake. They have a great sense of themselves.
Isn't that great? We're
lucky for that.
Yeah, yeah. If anyone is considering cosmetic surgeries, and they can email you or, you know, send something out to your website, what would you say to them?
Well, I do. I have people write me. My website is marymcdonough.com, and there's a whole segment in there called In the Know, which is a group that I had started. And you can read other people's stories and ask questions. I say really be with yourself inside and know what your motivation is.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's something, you know, if it's something that you can work with, you know, because people think, oh, she's anti-implant. I'm not anti-implant. I'm pro-information. Know that you may never get a clean mammogram. You're going to have to pay for extra angles to be shot with an implant. Your mammogram may rupture your implant. If you have a history of breast cancer in your family, early detection is key, and you may not find it with an implant in place because it's opaque and it can block part of the breast tissue. Know that you're going to have to pay for them for the rest of your life to be, you know, redone every 7 to 9 years. And then sometimes you can lose health care coverage, in America at least, because you have had an implant, and anything that happens because of it won't ever be covered. Some people have been completely lost coverage. They won't take you into their plan if you have had breast implants. And just really know the inner reasons of why you're doing it. If you're doing it for somebody else, or you're doing it for some, you know, pointing to some other reason, then really sit with that and figure out if there's another way that you can achieve that sense of self-esteem or that feeling good about yourself without doing it.
Now, did you, when you met your husband now, the love of your life, right?
Yes.
When you met him now, did you have the breast implants or you didn't?
I did not, no.
You didn't.
I've had my
okay.
implants out for 17 years.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I had scars and stuff but when I met him, so that, you know.
Well, that's why I was going to ask you. I mean, there must be some sort of, there's some damage there, you know, and probably some loss. I know that they say that there is loss of sensitivity and whatnot. I mean, so you have to come to the table with this saying, you know what, I had this, but now I don't. How do you feel about that?
It is. It really eliminates, you know, certain kinds of people out of your life, you know, and my husband is great, and he didn't care at all. I mean, it was such a non-issue for him, and that's part of what makes him really a great man.
Yeah.
I had someone stop dating me once because I have lupus.
Yeah. Oh.
I just said, I can't deal with it. I can't deal with it at all. And so you really need to, you know, you need to bring what you have to the table and say, here's my life. And everybody has their baggage. And I guess, as you know, they say you've got to find someone whose baggage is compatible with yours, that matches yours. Like I have blue luggage, and black and blue go well together. Great.
Liz and Mary, your journey is so inspiring. We're actually at the end of our show. I can't believe it. It went by so fast.
I can't believe it.
I know. I've got to have you. You've got to come back on. You know I'm moving over to another station. We'll talk about that. I know we can get your book on your website. I want to make sure everyone gets out there. I don't think there's any woman out there who hasn't gone through body image and self-doubt. So pick up this wonderful book. Mary, thank you so much for being here and inspiring our listeners. You are as sweet as Erin always was, and you've certainly become a wonderful Mary.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You are a blessing. And I know Mary knows who my next week's guest is, because next week, Thursday, June 21st, our special guest will be Alison Arngrim. So you remember Alison as little Nellie Olson on the series Little House on the Prairie? Well, she's all grown up now, too. She's written a wonderful book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson, Learned to Love Being Hated. So we're going to have so much fun with Alison next week. That brings our show to a close. I want to remind everybody to be an organ donor. Go to www.beadonor.ca. Pick up the latest issue of SNAP for all the information going on in your community. I hope that we brought a smile to you today and you took back something that will really make you think. Hope everyone has a great day, and we will see you next week. Take care, everyone.